Beis Shvat, Rabbi Yitzchok Ziskin, Nesias Halev.
Good morning, gentlemen, and thank you very much for the opportunity and the privilege of being able to speak to you. The Nefesh Achayim brings that one of the most important concepts is that we made B'Tzelem Elokim. And then he discusses what does that mean to be made B'Tzelem Elokim. We can have no concept of what a Kodesh Baruch Hu is. A Kodesh Baruch Hu is infinite and we are finite. So in what way can we be an image of the infinite? So he says one aspect of a Kodesh Baruch Hu that we can appreciate that that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is constantly creating the universe, creating the world. Not that he created the world, but he's constantly creating it. And so a more accurate translation of Breishis Boro would not be in the beginning God created, but in the beginning of God's creating. And we are a reflection of that, an image of that, in the sense that we, whether we want to or not, are in a position to constantly create ourselves. No human being is ever static. Moshel is like a bird in the sky, is never anywhere in the sky. If it flaps its wings, it goes up. If it stops flapping its wings, it goes down. So we are in a constant state of flux. And either we are the product of the influences around us, both negative and positive, or we take ourselves in hand to some degree and we define who we are by the use of our bechira and the way that we act and how we view ourselves and our aspirations. What I want to discuss now is one aspect of the means by which we can create ourselves. Very, very fascinating. It's brought in Chazal that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu commanded Klal Yisrael to build the Mishkan, so he called for two different categories of volunteers. One, the obvious one, people who had Nediva Salev, who were motivated to give, and they gave with all their heart. There was no tax. Each was required that a person should give b'chol lev full-heartedly to build the Mishkan. And so they were the people who provided the gold, the silver, all the building materials, and everything that was necessary to build the Mishkan. But the problem was, who would build it? Not one single person in Klal Yisrael, while we were in Mitzrayim, went to some sort of training school to learn how to work with gold, to work with silver, carpentry, to do all the intricate things that were necessary to build the Mishkan. The women never had any training in weaving. They were slaves and all they could do is make bricks. The women even had to make the bricks. The Egyptians caused that women should do men's work and men should do women's work. So now there was a problem. Who's going to build the Mishkan? Even with the Chochmah of Bezalel and so forth, you needed actually somebody to actually practically build the Mishkan. So people came with something called Nesias Halev, which means an inspired heart. What's an inspired heart? It is that a person with all their heart, with all their rotzen, wants to do the rotzen of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, wants to do something with all their heart. They have no idea how to do it. They have no idea to accomplish it. They haven't got what would seem to be the logical skills or the ability or the background or the capability to be able to do it. But they want to do it with all their heart. And so they came forth and somehow they found from within themselves the capacity. The woman found out how to weave and how to make the paroichas. And the men found out how to build the different elements of the Mishkan. Where did they find it from? So Rabbi Ezrahi brings that if you look at the creation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu endowed every single creature in the Bria with the ability to do and fulfill the purpose for which it was created. From the smallest microbe to the planets, everything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created has got a specific tafkid, and it does what it was created to do. In fact, in one opinion, that's the source from which Avraham Avinu derived the concept of chesed. Why? What is chesed? Chesed is ultimately to do what's needed from you. And he looked at the whole Bria, and he said, Oilam chesed yibona. He saw a creation where every single element in the creation never does what it wants, it does what's needed from it. It's forced to, it's got no bechira. It automatically does what's needed from you, it has a particular function. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu endowed every animal with the ability to do what it needs to do and to play its role in achieving an overall balance and harmony in nature. Shalom. And Avram said, if that's what causes the Bria to have shalom and harmony, so human beings have to be mechanech and have to find the ability to encourage each other to live a life of only doing what's needed from you. And if each person would do what's needed from them, what your wife needs, what your children, what your friend, what your situation, every situation you come in life, if you look at it, instead of what do I want to do, what is needed from me, you'll be able to ultimately get harmony. So, each creature, no lion had to go to hunting school. There's a bird born in Scotland called the tern, T-E-R-N, and that bird flies to the South Pole, not following its mother, with no training, no concept of navigation, no concept what the South Pole is, but its nature and its role in the whole Bria is it must fly to the South Pole. HaKadosh Baruch Hu endowed that bird with thousands of mirrors in its eyes, and the mirrors reflect the star formations. The bird doesn't know what stars are, the bird doesn't know what navigation is, and the bird is able to fly by itself all the way from Scotland, across Europe, across Eretz Yisrael, the Great Rift Valley, and to the South Pole. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave a bee the ability to build a hive. Incredible, bee doesn't know what a hexagon is, and yet this bee goes in that hive and builds exactly the right proportion, the exact mix. A spider, where did the spider learn how to make a web? It hasn't got a concept of a web. Somehow there's liquid inside the spider. As soon as it comes to hit the air, it becomes the most incredible tensile strength of thread that is just the right tensile strength for the spider to catch insects that the spider can kill and eat and won't be bigger and eat the spider. So if HaKadosh Baruch Hu endowed every Bria with the ability to do what it's supposed to do, He didn't endow us with that ability. We wouldn't have the ability to do what we're putting to this world to do. And what we're putting to this world is to become a reflection of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to become Balei Chesed, to bring Brocha, to bring Atzlocha. That's our function, to emulate HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So it must be that it's within us. But He didn't make it automatic, because He would have made it automatic. Would have been a thoughtless, we'd just be automatons, we'd do everything like robots, we'd be automatic tzaddikim. So He gave us the potential deep within us to be able to do anything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu requires of us, way beyond what we can imagine, way beyond what would be logical to expect. But we have to have this Nesias HaLev, this inspirational heart. You have to be inspired and want it. And I don't have to tell you, you've seen all of you, the kind of thing that happened after the war, where everything was destroyed. Mir Yeshiva, a few Talmid Chachomim, a few Rebbes, few people survived, Baruch Hashem. And nobody would have dreamt in their wildest dreams that we'd see Oilam of Torah, a revival, never, not necessarily perfect, but incredible. I witnessed it in South Africa where everything was finished. There was no possibility, and I was privileged to be part of what I consider a miracle that happened. How did it happen? Because of this idea of Nesias HaLev. People were inspired. People wanted it. And they wanted it, and without any real training or ability, they somehow found the ability to be able to achieve it. So, I want to take One example of an interesting person came across. I had the privilege to do the Daf Yomi the last cycle, which means I participated in the shiur. Not that I understand all the material or have any idea of the whole of the shas, but at least I saw most of the pages and I saw very interesting things. Came across Kalev. Of course, most of us know who Kalev is, but the Gemara brings from the Book of Chronicles an interesting description of an aspect of Kalev's life, and says that Kalev was Keilu Noildo Azuva. The Gemara asks, who's Azuva? And the Gemara says, well, she was actually Miriam. So why is she called Azuva? Because she was ill and nobody wanted to marry her because she wasn't attractive and because she was ill. And it says her face was like pale, like undyed cloth. And so she was getting quite odd in age, and she was Azuva, she was rejected by everybody. And Kalev appreciated who she could be, and being the sister of Moshe and Aaron, he also wasn't attracted to marry her, but it says that he fasted and did tshuva, and forced himself to marry her. And he married her, and he nursed her, and he brought her back to good health. And the Gemara says afterwards her cheeks blossomed like a rose, were red, and she in the end was amongst the most beautiful women in Klal Yisrael. And that's what it means, Keiru Noildo. He gave birth to her. He gave birth to her potentials. He helped her to become the person that she had the potential to become. And because of this, it's called Keilu Noilda. He gave birth to her. And then there's various descriptions of him, different names for him. It says, in fact, she had sons, but it says three names, and they each describe a quality of Kalev. And because she was the means by which Kalev developed into the person that he became, it's like he was her son. The Midas which he acquired as a result of his relationship with her, it's like she gave him those middas. She was a source of him getting those particular middas. And then the Gemara goes on to say, and in fact, when a shocking situation occurred in Klal Yisrael, that the Meraglim, the whole story of the Meraglim, we're on the point of going into Eretz Yisrael, and we asked Moshe Rabbeinu, we wanted to send Meraglim, and so forth, and Meraglim went and unfortunately were overcome by COVID and so forth, various other explanations, and they came back and they gave such a negative report. Impossible, walled cities, too strong for us, there's no way we can go into Eretz Yisrael. And everybody panicked and everybody started crying, and of course that's the source of Tisha B'Av. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu then made a gezeira, that's the end of Klal Yisrael. And it was all over. Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron bowed down in a sense of resigning altogether. And it was the end. And Kalev, out of nowhere, seemingly, got up and he said, weren't this man Ben Amram talking as if he's insulting Moshe Rabbeinu so he could at least get the floor so the Almaraglim give him a chance to speak? And then he just said one thing. He said, we can go. We can go. Where did he get the strength? Where did he get the ability to stand up against all the Meraglim who are greater, most of them greater than him? And the whole prevailing attitude and the atmosphere of absolute depression and that there's no future? He fasted and did tshuva in the same way as he did that to get himself to marry Miriam. The same effort that he went through, that prepared him and that set him up for this moment to be able to save Klal Yisrael. And he prepared, he went to Hebron, to Davin, to prepare himself for the challenge. He didn't get a brocha from Moshe Rabbeinu like Yeshua had. Yeshua needed to get that brocha, I once heard from Matisyo Solomon saying, why did Moshe Rabbeinu give the bracha to Yeshua and not to Kalev? Because Yeshua was vulnerable. Yeshua was a Talmid of Moshe Rabbeinu so much, and he loved him so much that he could get carried away by his Yetzer Hara when he would realize that Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to go into Eretz Yisrael, and he's going to die before they go into Eretz Yisrael, and he may come up with some rationalization that Yetzer Hara can dray a person a kop, and he would come up and he'd be on the side, or he'd go in with a meraglim in the negative report. So to protect him because of his particular vulnerability of his closeness to Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe Rabbeinu gave him a bruch and he didn't give it to Kalev. Kalev was able to manage on his own, in a sense, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's help, and he went to Hebron and Davin in order to get the ability to stand up, and he saved Klal Yisrael. With a few, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, because of Kalev, I changed my gezeira, and Klal Yisrael was saved. Now, I have got two interesting stories of what that inspiration, where did Kalev get the square? He was inspired. He wanted to save Klal Yisrael. He wanted to do something. And all he had to do is say, we can. Can you explain to us why? He couldn't. I couldn't explain to them. He couldn't rationalize with them. There was not a time for rationalization. But he spoke a word of absolute inspiration that we can. It has to be that we can. And so HaKadosh Baruch Hu came up with a pshora. Klal Yisrael wanted to go back to Mitzrayim. Originally, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to go into Eretz Yisrael. He came up 40 years in the desert, was a pshora, and that generation would die out and so forth because of Kalev. Because of Kalev. Now, my brother, Gesundse Lazan, lives in South Africa. And many years ago, there was a Hasidish young man who was in the diamond business, and he wanted to come to South Africa to do business. My brother was not in that business at all, and he needed a place for Shabbos, so he stayed with my brother for Shabbos. Eventually they became good friends, and eventually they went into business, in the diamond business together, and they've been going more or less for many years in that business. And his name, actually a very interesting story, his name is Wolf, Laser Wolf, as it happens. And he, from the character, not the same Laser Wolf, and he told me the following story. He told me that when the Germans invaded Poland, they came to the city where his family lived, and they, of course, made a ghetto, and they forced all the Jews to go into the ghetto. And his mother, at the time, was pregnant. And her doctor was a Roman Catholic woman, a doctor who lived just out, not too far from the ghetto. And in the early days, people could go in and out of the ghetto. And so one day, his mother went to the doctor for an appointment. And at the end of the appointment, the doctor said to her, "Don't go back to the ghetto. I've heard that the Germans are going to seal it off. And I've got a small attic at the top of my house, and if you'll stay with me, I'll hide you in that attic, and I'll hopefully be able to provide you with enough food and take away waste, whatever it is, and you'll be able to be hidden over there, and you'll be able to be saved." And she said, "I can't do it. I've got a husband. How can I do such a thing?" We said, "All right, go and bring your husband." She came to her husband. Husband said, "Of course, we've got parents. How can we leave our parents?" And one thing and another, eventually 13 people were taken and by this woman and hidden in the attic. And they didn't want to talk too much about what happened. I think the baby didn't survive. But you can imagine 13 people in a confined attic with sloping ceilings, half of the floor space. You couldn't stand up properly, and they had to do all the private things and everything that a person needs to do together in this limited space, 13 people, even though they were family. It was a shocking experience. They had to walk around in stocking feet. They could never go out and never make a sound. And a certain amount of the time, apparently the Gestapo occupied a building next door, so they had to be very careful to be quiet. And she managed somehow to provide them with what they needed, and they managed to survive. and they were in this attic for 23 months, almost 2 years. And somehow, at that point, I think they contacted partisans, and they got into the forests, and eventually the family went to America, and they lived in New York. And when the first Einikel, the first grandchild, got married, they brought this Roman Catholic woman doctor that saved their life to the Chasana. And at the Chasana, there was over 200 people from these 13. So can you imagine what an experience it must have been? And then one of them asked her, why did you do it? What caused you to do this? So she said, you know, I'm a religious woman, and I'm also a very great patriot of my country, Poland. And I read in the Bible that when the spies came back and they gave an evil report and God wanted to destroy the Jewish people, that Kalev got up and he said these few words and he saved the Jewish people. And I hoped by this action which I did, and perhaps there'd be other Polish people who'd also do something like that, God would save Poland. Of course, there wasn't enough people, and Poland suffered a negative experience after the Second World War and so forth. Until today, maybe it's a bit better and so forth. And here is Kalev, because he fasted to marry Miriam, and that gave him the koyach to be able to stand up against the whole situation, the whole of Klal Yisrael, all of the rugging and everything else. And he saved Klal Yisrael. Over 3,000 years later, a Roman Catholic woman saved 13 Jews' lives because of that. What an Asiyas Aleif can achieve. And I don't know what, you don't know what else, that inspiration, anybody reads the story of Kalev and so forth, who knows what happened and so forth and so on. And so the ramifications, the consequences of a person going the Maila Min HaTeva, acting with Nesiyas HaLev, can have infinite consequences. I imagine today they were Hasidish family, so I imagine there must be many thousand people from that 13 today, and this and so forth from that action, going back to the action by Kalev. Then a completely different story, a completely different context altogether. So when I was an architect in South Africa, so I had an office and I had a secretary, and whenever Rosh Hashivas, Mishalochim, anybody used to come to South Africa to collect money, so I'd help them open up a bank account, and I'd let them, all they had to do is bring their checks and their money to my secretary, and she'd bank it for them. And so they didn't have the worry of the whole administration, and they just had to collect the money, and then afterward we'd try and help them to find a way to get the money out of South Africa to Eretz Yisrael and so forth. So one day, a lady came, Rebbetzin. She happened to be Ruth Blau, very interesting lady. She was born as a Catholic in Belgium, and she and her mother, during the war, saved many Jews' lives. And after the war, she was Magaya. And she got a chuck into her head that she wants to marry nobody other than Amram Blau. Amram Blau was the head of the Nature Carter, and he was a widower. His wife had passed away. And I don't know the details, but anyhow, she did get married to him. She was married to him. What an amazing shidduch. And apparently she thought from them could come Mashiach and so forth, whatever it is. Anyway, once when she was in South Africa collected for an old age home, Meshav's Kainim, so at that point, her husband was Nifta. So she was sitting Shiva at the Korn's house in Johannesburg, and I went with Rabbi Saunders to visit her. And we were talking, and in the conversation, she's told a few things about her husband. She's told us one thing. She said, you know, people thought my husband was very extreme and so forth and so on, because now we go to Eretz Yisrael, and you've got many areas where there's Shmiras Shabbos, where no cars go. But in the early days, there was no such thing. There were very, very few areas, even Meir Shorim, people used to come and be Mechal Shabbos and so forth and so on. So how did the situation change? The government certainly didn't decide that they're going to allocate areas in anywhere in Eretz Yisrael for Haredim and people who Shomer Mitzvahs to be able to have a Shabbos. Each street had to be fought for. Had to be demonstrations and so forth and so on. And Rabbi Amram Blau was one of those who was in the early days the one who initiated. And every Shabbos, she says, my husband would stand on the corner and the taxi, Jewish taxi drivers and everybody would be driving past, whoever it was, and he would stand and shout, Shabbos, 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 Shabbos. You all know the story and so forth. And because he was creating a disturbance, the police would come and tell him to keep quiet, otherwise they'd beat him up and sometimes even arrest him and so forth. And she said, you know, her husband once told her, you know, I couldn't imagine, I don't know what words he used, that actually because a taxi driver hears me shouting Shabbos, Shabbos, and he's Mechal Shabbos, that he's going to say, oh, the rabbi shouted Shabbos, he's now going to stop driving. So he couldn't imagine that his actions would actually achieve that somebody would start to keep Shabbos. But he said, I remembered Kalev, and I thought to myself, that if Chas V'Sholem, the situation in Eretz Yisrael, for the Yishuv, for the Jews that live in Eretz Yisrael, is always in the balance. You've got, unfortunately, the inappropriate behavior of the vast majority of the population, and you've got elements of Klal Yisrael who are learning Torah and living a Torah life and being avoid Oivdei Hashem and so forth. And there's some kind of a balance. And if Chas V'Sholem, it starts to tilt against the schusim. There's not enough schusim of the yeshuv and for Klal Yisrael, that Eretz Yisrael should be safe and so forth and so on. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chas V'Sholem might have to make a negative decision. I hope that my shouting Shabbos would have a similar effect to Kalev. Like Kalev managed to do something, it seemed like a small thing, to do something. And unfortunately, we're looking now at a situation that is beginning to creep into Eretz Yisrael of Bochrim being taken out of yeshivas, not allowed to learn in yeshivas, to go into the army, and not that the army needs them. I saw that Eli Yishai said that they're not prepared to spend, there's boys who want to go into the Haredi, Nachal Haredi, and the army's not prepared to spend money to set up new units. They don't need them. But they want them out of yeshiva. And they want them, if they don't go into the army, there's no, so they want them to go and waste 2 years. And what did Barak, Mr. Barak say? He said, what will they do? Let them clean dustbins. Let them clean toilets. But they have to come and serve. He wants to get them out of yeshivas. Now if this Chas V'Sholem, who knows, it's Bidei Hashem, if this proliferates, it will certainly take away one of the major schusim of the whole enterprise in Eretz Yisrael to be able to have a very positive future. And Rabbi Amram Blau was, he hoped, with his actions, and we should learn from that. We don't know. It's a little action. You never imagine what you can do. 2 words you can say to a person on an airplane can change a person's life. You can just try with unbelievable what a person can do. I just have to, one thing I want to say, I'm always upset when I'm referred to as a rabbi, because it's just not the truth. I've got sons who've got smicha, I've got sons-in-law, but I'm from that lost generation, born in South Africa in 1937, and growing up in a little town outside Johannesburg. Baruch Hashem, my father was Shomer Shabbos, at least I kept Shabbos, we kept kosher. And then I found it afterwards, my mother secretly went to Johannesburg to the mikveh. We didn't know, you never heard such a word in South Africa. We used to drop her off somewhere to go and visit a lady, and so forth. And why, how did she do it? Because of a few words in 1936, when my father had gone to, he'd been in South Africa for 10 years, and he went back to get a frum wife, and he met my mother in Ponnevezh. And when the train was pulling out of the station in Ponnevezh, my bobba ran next to the train, and the last word she said to my mother, Abba Shalom, well, you must promise to go to mikveh. And when they came to Johannesburg, the mikveh was run down and the water wasn't clean. It was so depressing and so forth. And my father took my mother and she just couldn't go in. And he said, remember what your mother said as the train pulled, the last words you ever heard from your mother. Of course, they died, perished in the Holocaust and so forth. So from those few words, just those few words, we had something. And from that, you could build. And I can't imagine what happened in South Africa. And how, I just want to say, I was inspired by these. I had certain rabbis I met, certain things I read. Kodesh Baruch Hu sent it my way. And I wanted to do, but I didn't know anything. We finished our education at Bar Mitzvah, the little education that we had. And then a miracle happened. I found tapes from Rabbi Avigdor Miller. So I started to listen to the tapes. And I ended up with a miraculous thing. Gates said, I went to university to study town planning. My professor said, go to University of Newcastle. Never heard of the place in my life. And so forth and so on. And then I wanted to teach, but I couldn't teach. And then one rabbi once came to me and he said, I want you to give a shiur. I said, how can I give a shiur? You know, I can give a sicha, I can give a talk. You know, I was in B'nai Kiva, I can give that. I want to give a shiur. So I sat down and copied out an Avigdor Miller tape. It takes about 13 to 15 hours. And I read the shiur. It's my basic shiur on Shabbos, which I still give now. And then I did another one, and another one, another one. And then I said, I can give shiur in. So I set it up at university with students, medical school. That's where I met Rabbi Tatz and got him to come for Shabbos and so forth. And in the end, I became, listen to me, standing over here. What right have I got with my background to stand here and be able to share these lofty thoughts and so forth? To a certain extent, I think it's something to do with Nesias HaLev. That's why I'm so fascinated to have come across this idea. So it's amazing what we can do. Kodesh Baruch Hu gave us Avraham Avinu, what chance did he stand? Moshe Rabbeinu, what chance did he stand? David HaMelech, with everything loaded against him. So please God, we should all be inspired to find that potential greatness that has been there all the time. And just to end off, very fascinating, Rabbi Noach Weinberg, Zeichet Tzadik Livrocha, the Rosh Yeshiva Eish HaTorah, used to define the difference between brainwashing and chinuch. And most education is brainwashing. It means the teacher convinces the pupil or loads the pupil with information, and the pupil just has to take that information and give it back in exams and questions and so forth. So what is chinuch? So the Noach Weinberg said, when you teach a person what they know, you ignite from within them the appreciation. And so the ability is not something you have to get from out. Lo b'shamayim hi, v'lo ma'eber hayam, ki b'ficha l'vavcha l'asoysa. It's been there all the time. All that potential is all the time. We just have to unlock it. And how does one? One of the ways we unlock it is with Nesias HaLev, to be inspired to want to do it. Please God, we should all be able, on an increasing level, to fulfill the Rotzon HaKodesh Baruch Hu. Thank you. Yeah.